This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Today's lecture will focus on the North American Free Trade Agreement and its impact on the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, and the pros and cons as all three countries contemplate moving toward a new era of free trade and economic integration through the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. David Shirk is a visiting associate professor at IRPS and an associate professor at the University of San Diego. He received his bachelor's degree in international studies at Lock Haven University, where he studied and has studied abroad in Mexico, Japan, and the Soviet Union. He received his master's and PhD in political science right here at UC San Diego. And he was a fellow at the U.S.-Mexico Center from 1998 to 1999 and 2001 to 2003. Please join me in welcoming David Shirk back to Osher.
Good morning. First of all, I want to say thank you to Steve and especially appreciate his excellent instructions on how to get here. I would have been here sooner. It wasn't a question of distance so much as finding my way to the parking, which is a perennial challenge on this campus. So thank you all for your patience. I want to talk today about four talking points. I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of the North American Free Trade Agreement, sort of how it came into being, and the process of the making of NAFTA. I want to also spend most of my time talking about what NAFTA has meant, or at least what has happened under NAFTA during the last 20 years or so. And lastly, I think we'll need to talk about the future for NAFTA, or really the future for the North American Free Trade area in the current context. I mean, today, this morning, was the start of a trilateral summit between Canada, Mexico, and the United States, which is taking place in Mexico, in Toluca, very close to Mexico City. So this is a very timely topic, and I appreciate the opportunity from Osher to be able to discuss this with you today. First, I just want to go back like 200 years to talk a little bit about where all of this comes from. The whole idea of free trade is a relatively new endeavor in the global economy. And it goes back to 1776, the other important document, right, that was written in 1776. Aside from the Declaration of Independence, Adam Smith's classic work on free trade, The Wealth of Nations, which really tried to understand how economic exchange between countries could facilitate a better outcome for both countries. Up until that point, up until the late 18th century, most of the world operated on a model of economic exchange in which everybody viewed, or every country viewed every other country as a potential enemy, and that any exchange, any trade might help their potential enemy. So you don't trade, for example, if you're Great Britain, you don't trade wheat with France, even if France is better at making wheat, because you're giving money to France, and that would be a bad thing. As a result, what you do is you empower wheat producers in your own country by putting up tariffs, putting up trade barriers to keep the French wheat out, but then you're paying an exorbitant amount for that wheat. And that's that philosophy, which Adam Smith called mercantilism or state intervention or whatever you want to call it. That's the philosophy that dominated trade relationships up until very recently in the world. We went through a number of changes after Adam Smith wrote his book. Britain actually changed its laws on the importation of wheat and corn, the so-called corn laws. That change led to about a century-long effort to liberalize trade arrangements so that free exchange would enable countries to specialize and develop their areas of comparative advantage. And that's the concept of specialization And trade liberalization is what was developed by thinkers like Smith and also David Ricardo. There are some problems with this idea, and this is something that Marx pointed to and other critics of free trade have pointed to ever since the time of Adam Smith. One is the fact that this leads to competition, and even though in theory international trade can lead countries to have better outcomes overall, across both countries, it can also lead to problems of competition, such as unfair competition practices, violating, say, ethical or legal standards, such as having tiny little children with nimble fingers sew our sneakers together in other countries. Markets are amoral, and so when you have unbridled market competition, that can lead to practices that are amoral for society or immoral from the view of society. There's also the problem of the costs of economic adjustment. When we talk about allowing free trade and allowing certain industries to excel and others to go by the wayside, going by the wayside is a painful process, right? And if your industry happens to be one of those industries that is not competitive, it means that you're going to lose your job, and you may not be able to find another job in a similar sector at a similar wage, and that is a painful process. It leads to a strong political give and take about this issue of free trade. The other is that it's not just about how much you make. It's about what you do. And for a lot of people, their job is their way of life, and it's a way of life that may stretch back across many generations. So if your dad was a farmer and suddenly you're competing against foreign farmers who can do your job better, you're going to lose that job, and you're going to lose that family farm, or you're going to lose basically something that you felt was very dear to you. You could go from being a steel worker to becoming a nurse. But that's a major transition in terms of who you are, and that's hard to measure in dollars and cents, but it's an important aspect of all of this. And the last is national security concerns. One of the biggest areas of anxiety for a lot of countries is the idea of having someone else grow their food, having someone else produce something that is so essential to their survival. And that's a big transition and change and something to give up. But what we can see from NAFTA, and I think NAFTA offers a few lessons, is number one, NAFTA is first and foremost a symbol of what a new era of globalization means. During the middle part of the 20th century, some of the principles of Adam Smith were rolled back. There was this thing called the Soviet Union, Steve mentioned it, that emphasized state intervention in the economy. And beyond that, of course, John Maynard Keynes and other economists who advocated building in protections and encouraging state involvement in the economy in ways that violated the free market principles of Adam Smith. NAFTA was part of a major transition in global economic thinking towards a new liberalization of markets, or what some people call neoliberalism. And what that involved in many different places, and particularly here in North America, was, first of all, the introduction of free trade agreements, rolling back tariff barriers and other subsidies, things that reduce the competitiveness of certain sectors in a given economy. We saw NAFTA basically as become a model for other free trade agreements that people either implemented, such as CAFTA, or dreamed about, such as the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or currently the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP. We also saw NAFTA become an important, I would say, metaphor, if not a process that helped to move forward the idea of regional integration in North America, the idea that we have become more interdependent between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. And that has been very important in terms of the larger overall movement towards regional trade blocs that we've seen in the last roughly 30, 40 years in Europe and also increasingly in Asia. And finally, NAFTA, I think, became the symbol of the paradoxes of a borderless world. While all of this wonderful economic integration and the idea of a united North America was being advanced, at the same time, you saw a hardening of borders in the United States vis-a-vis both Canada and Mexico in ways that seemed to go against the very philosophy of globalization. With regard to the trade bloc thing, just one important point here. 80% of global trade takes place in one of three major trade blocs, the ones that I mentioned, North America, Europe, and Asia. So when you want to think about the importance of the North American trade bloc, keep in mind that most of the trade occurs in one of these three areas, and most of the trade within those three areas occurs within each of those areas. We don't actually trade that much with our partners or our friends in Europe or in Asia, with one big exception in Asia, China. But much of our trade, most of our trade, in fact, actually occurs within our North American region. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind as we look forward. So let's talk a little bit about the background on North America, the North American Free Trade Agreement. First of all, as I sort of suggested in this sort of general background, you know, North America's movement towards a common trade area or a free trade area really has some of its roots in this shift in the general economic thinking that we saw over the course of the last 20 or 30 years. Since the 1970s, a movement towards principles of free trade, of freer markets, has dominated. And that has led, starting in the early 1980s, to very similar kinds of anti-inflationary measures in all three countries. Greater emphasis on fiscal austerity, cutting budgets for primarily for the federal government, but we've seen at the state and local level. In other words, reducing the size of the state in the economy. And along with that, greater privatization and deregulation. Deregulation, for example, of AT&T in the 1980s or Telmex, Telephones of Mexico or Teléfonos de México as well in the 1980s. And along with this general principle of free market ideals has been the idea of greater trade openness. And, of course, the North American Free Trade Agreement has its roots in greater Canada-Mexico integration and free trade through the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement in the late 1980s. Very quickly, or very soon after Canada and Mexico signed a free trade agreement, the United States turned to Mexico and said, hey, we would like to have a similar kind of free trade agreement with you. Canada heard that and said, let's just make it a trilateral free trade agreement rather than have two separate bilateral agreements. And voila, we saw the beginnings of the negotiation of NAFTA under the administrations of or the administration of President George W. Bush, who had fast track authority to negotiate this agreement. If without so-called fast track authority, any agreements that he might bring before Congress would be subject to amendments, to filibuster, which existed back then. You could basically, this is a small joke, it still exists, mostly. But the idea of fast track authority, or what is increasingly referred to as trade promotion authority, is that the president has the ability essentially to broker broad stroke agreements that won't be tampered with by legislators. And that is intended to help facilitate the process. It's also seen by critics of these kinds of agreements as a way of preventing a greater public scrutiny and greater public participation in the determination of the nature of these agreements. And in any event, there was considerable debate about NAFTA. When NAFTA was brought before the U.S. Congress, it was negotiated in 1991, came before the U.S. Congress in 1993, and came also before the Mexican and Canadian legislatures. But it was in the United States that we saw, I would say, the greatest debate about what NAFTA was going to mean. And, of course, Ross Perot famously voiced some of the concerns about what NAFTA would imply with a famous phrase that NAFTA would create a giant sucking sound of U.S. jobs flowing south across the border. That expressed some of the major concerns. Of course, one of the first being jobs. U.S. unions and U.S. businesses, especially small and medium-sized businesses, were afraid that they would not be able to compete in certain ways. Mexico, in particular, is a labor-abundant country, and some jobs simply can be done cheaper south of the border. Along with that, there was an expectation that within North America and even in the United States, we would see an erosion of labor conditions, particularly because of differential rules for workers south of the border. A similar concern was environmental standards. The fact that there might be some kind of race to the bottom as businesses located south of the border and took advantage of lesser environmental protections. And finally, there was fear that because of the displacement effects of economic restructuring that are necessarily part of free trade and this whole idea that Adam Smith put forward many, many years ago, that in the end, NAFTA would lead to the uprooting of many millions of Mexicans in the countryside and in certain sectors, and that they would come north looking for jobs here. Basically, corn farmers in rural Mexico who couldn't compete with Monsanto and major agricultural producers in the United States would wind up somehow migrating north of the border and growing corn here, which is what happened. Now, of course, in part through a series of agreements, Bill Clinton was able to negotiate side agreements on to alleviate labor concerns, re-education programs for labor, as well as some environmental side agreements, which included the creation of special foundations or funds, the North American Development Bank and the Binational Economic Commission, the NADBank and the BEC, which could help to address some of those environmental and labor concerns. NAFTA passed thanks to sort of an effort to massage the politics of the agreement and of the concerns. So now when we look at NAFTA, what really happened is the question 20 years later. Did the worst fears of NAFTA's opponents come true? Were its proponents right that NAFTA would be a major job creator and a force for innovation in North America? Well, it really depends on which part of the tail or which part of the animal you want to grab a hold of, right? Let's start with some of the more positive trends. Looking at NAFTA by the numbers, one of the things that we can say is that we are a really rich region. There's very little debate that NAFTA has been successful on the measure of say, economic growth, that the NAFTA region has grown economically to become one of the most important trading blocks in the world. NAFTA represents approximately $20 trillion of overall annual economic productivity. Now, we're a big part of that. We're like 15 out of the 20. You throw in Canada and Mexico, you get us to 20 trillion, right? There's roughly 35, 40 million Canadians. There's 110 million Mexicans. And when you add them to our economy, we are the largest economy in the world up until, I think, a year or two ago when Europe surpassed us. You can look at the $1 trillion in annual U.S., Mexican, and Canadian trade, which is a stunning figure. You can look at the two-thirds of that, two-thirds of $1 trillion that represents U.S.-Canada trade over the course of just last year. That's $600 billion. And you can also look at the roughly $500 million half a trillion dollars in U.S.-Mexico trade over the last year, about $520 billion in 2013. You should also look, as I'll discuss shortly, at the $180 billion U.S. trade deficit with those two countries, but we'll get there. I'm not going to go into great detail on some of these statistics. I put this here since some of you may want to look at this presentation later. But there are some interesting things to point out about these three countries. I got the numbers mixed up on population. Mexico is not bigger than us. Sorry about that. One small detail. Just flip those two numbers. We are the largest country in the region. One of the things that's really interesting is we are not as rich as our Canadian neighbors, and even in terms of purchasing power, in terms of per capita GDP. So Canada stands out in that regard. Our economy is way bigger. It's, as I said, over $15 trillion last year. 2012, it was about $17 trillion. So you bundle Mexico and Canada together, and it looks quite impressive. Two quick things I want to point out. One is Mexico stands out in terms of poverty. About 40% of people in Mexico live under the Mexican poverty line, which is calculated typically at about $5 a day. So that's a stunning figure, and it suggests that that figure hasn't changed a whole lot over the last 20 years. And that is disappointing, and it is something that is a subject of, I think, that should be a subject of of great scrutiny. We have seen quick point is, you look at the Gini number here. Gini coefficient is a calculation of levels of inequality. A perfectly equal society would have a Gini coefficient of close to zero, and a perfectly unequal society would have a Gini coefficient closer to 100 by this measure. What's really interesting is both Mexico and the United States, relatively unequal societies compared to our Canadian neighbors. Mexico, of course, has this much larger share of its population that lives in poverty, but it also has tremendous wealth. In fact, the wealthiest man in the world, depending on the day and the stock market and whether he's buying and selling, making certain trades, is Carlos Slim, the great telecommunications magnate of Mexico. On the other days, it's Bill Gates or the other guy, Berkshire Hathaway. Buffett, not Warren. Warren, not Jimmy. But we're looking at some really interesting dynamics going on. And one of the last things I'd like to point out in terms of things that we should pay attention to in North America is debt. Whereas Mexico and Canada have been pretty responsible, relatively speaking, in recent years in maintaining a manageable debt level. If they had to pay off all their debt in 1 year, they could do so and still have some money left over to eat. In the United States, we would have to go a whole year with no eating in order to pay off our debt, at least our public debt. And that's of course, a big concern, and I'll point that out in a little more detail later. So what has happened in 20 years? For one thing, NAFTA's growth, the NAFTA region has grown. And that's an important acknowledgement. The NAFTA economy has increased very significantly in terms of overall productivity, GDP, across the NAFTA region. And a lot of NAFTA proponents will point to this and say that NAFTA has been a great success in that regard. The question is always, how much of that growth is attributable to NAFTA? This is an especially important question because when you look at the data prior to 1994, you had the same trajectory. It was the exact same trajectory. So NAFTA did not really stimulate a huge change in that trajectory. Arguably, what's much more important is the convergence factor that I mentioned earlier. All three of these countries were moving in this direction already. NAFTA helped to put a name or a label on the process of North American regional integration and helped us to understand this as a concept. That's one suggestion I would make. What we have also seen in terms of the NAFTA region is, of course, this key question of, did NAFTA increase trade? Well, again, it's not clear that it's NAFTA that was increasing trade, but trade certainly increased across the three countries very significantly. And arguably, trade would have increased even more than it did had we not had a couple of stumbling blocks starting around 2001. 2001, of course, we had 9/11. That introduced new border security measures that have been a huge tax on NAFTA. Just in this region alone, in the San Diego-Tijuana region, the San Diego Association of Governments calculates that each year we lose about $6 billion in potential trade because of border wait times, because people are unwilling to go down, spend a lovely day in wine country, and then come back and wait 2 or 3 hours to get back into the United States. If the border didn't exist, Sandag suggests, or if you didn't have the long wait times that we did, you would see an additional $6 billion in trade. Now, keep in mind, the figure I gave you earlier was for the whole NAFTA, for the U.S. and Mexico, you have about $500 billion in trade. That's $500 billion. So add that $6 billion to that, but then add that number all along the border, and you would have, during this period, significantly increased overall U.S.-Mexico trade if you had a truly smart border, a border that allowed good things to come through relatively smoothly and relatively quickly, but could somehow keep out the bad things that we want to keep out. Emphasizing this point, I'll just illustrate here how important the border is, and particularly efficient crossing of trucks to U.S.-Mexico trade, particularly for us here in California. You know, most of the goods, most of the movement of commerce in the NAFTA region and in our particular corner of the U.S.-Mexico border is really about moving trucks. So if we want to have more jobs, we're going to need to make sure that trucks can move quickly enough across the border to keep people working and producing. Now, of course, the thing to point out here is Mexico is much more important than many people realize. Only about one in five Americans knows that Mexico is our second largest destination, second most important destination for exports. Only about one in five Americans knows that. It is our biggest source of, or second biggest source of export-oriented jobs. So when you want to think about the importance or the value of Mexico to our economy, you have to recognize that Mexico buys more U.S. exports than China and Japan combined. Mexico buys more U.S. exports than the United Kingdom, Germany, and France combined. So if we could only remember that slide earlier, the average Mexican earns about $11,000. If we could triple their or quadruple Mexico's income to be more similar to Canada's or the United States, they'd be buying a lot more iPods, and that would be really good for us. So thinking about ways to help Mexico is a way of helping ourselves. There is another country that sort of wedges itself in when you look at imports, and that's China. You can see that China is the number two source of imports for all, for both Canada and Mexico, and it is our, no, actually for all three. Sorry, for all three countries, it is our number two source of imports. Canada slightly edges out China as our to be our number one source of imports here in the United States, and we are the number one source of imports for both Canada and Mexico. They buy a lot of our stuff. They're extremely dependent on their U.S. Neighbor, and that's something I think we often fail to appreciate. I mentioned earlier this issue of deficits. The overall trade deficit with Canada and Mexico increased dramatically in the first 15 years of the NAFTA agreement, and it has more or less leveled off with Mexico and remained, I would say, high. It's fallen the last couple of years with Canada for a number of reasons. The point is, we have significant trade deficits with these two particular partners. And one could say that is an illustration of one of the liabilities of NAFTA. It's important to point out that 40% of our imports that we bring from Mexico, of the component part imports, is actually U.S.-produced goods. And that's an important aspect. The other issue is, of course, this is part of a bigger problem. our deficit relationship with Canada and Mexico is a sort of just microcosm of our deficit relationship with the world, and particularly with China. We've run high deficits, and we've paid for those high deficits with a lot of borrowing. And that's eventually going to come home to roost. That is eventually going to have to change in some way. We're going to have to figure out how to balance that out, at least in our ability to pay back some of the debt. But the key point I wanted to emphasize here is that 40% number. We have a revolving door trade model with Mexico. When we want to build a car in North America, we no longer just build that car here in Michigan. We build part of that car in Mexico, maybe in Toluca, or parts in Querétaro. There's a big Bosch factory, for example, a German car manufacturer that has located in Toluca. Its parts help to fuel auto production or support auto production not only in Mexico but also in the United States. The net result is that millions of U.S. jobs actually depend on this trade with Mexico. Some estimates suggest that 6 million U.S. jobs are dependent across many different parts of the country with Mexico. And Mexico is the top, second, or third largest trading partner of almost all of the 50 states. Right, it has a very high presence in terms of output, its trade relationship throughout the country, not just in the border states. And again, very few Americans are aware of this point. And I think that that ignorance significantly colors our discourse on Mexico. The lack of recognition of Mexico as an important trading partner, an important part of our economy, means that we tend to look at Mexico as sort of this needy neighbor. Well, guess what? We need Mexico just as much, I would say, as Mexico, or nearly as much as Mexico needs us. The last point I want to talk about is job growth. Over the last 20 years, we've seen significant job growth under NAFTA. Of course, along with that job growth, this is job growth in the United States, the number of jobs created in the United States, and the numbers are something like, I think, 20 million jobs created since over the last 20 years. Again, the question is how many of those jobs were created by NAFTA, how many jobs were lost under NAFTA? And the figure that you often hear from NAFTA's critics is about 1 million jobs were lost directly in attributable to... Yeah, sorry. This is total jobs. So job creation would be... So it's looking at the total number of jobs created in that time in just the United States in non-farm employment. Thousands would be 140 million? Yeah. In any event, if the one of the key questions is how many jobs were lost, right? 1 million jobs is the figure you hear. Somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million jobs is the figure that's thrown around by opponents of NAFTA. Overall, in the last 20 years, we've lost about 5 million manufacturing jobs in the United States. So about 20% of that loss might be attributable to NAFTA if we take critics of NAFTA at their word and that the number is 1 million. So you have to compare, you know, how do you weigh the 20 million jobs that have been created in the last 20 years to the roughly 5 million jobs that have been lost generally to globalization and the million that perhaps have been lost to NAFTA. It's really trying to weigh job creation against job loss, and it's a very tricky exercise. I think to round out the discussion, I mean, the key question is, where is all this going? Given that we don't really know that NAFTA has been an unmitigated success or an unmitigated failure, what can we say about the future of North America and the future of regional competitiveness? I mean, there are some, there are many people who are pointing to the possibility of enhancing the North American the North American trade area through greater energy independence. We've seen in the United States, in Canada and Mexico, the revelation of new shale oil deposits, which could potentially unleash a massive trove of energy for North America that would basically render the continent energy independent. And that would be a very, very good thing. Of course, opponents to shale gas the shale gas industry point out that it also bears some very significant economic costs in the region, and that's something that needs to really be, I think, fleshed out with greater discussion and debate. The second point is, we could, as I've mentioned in the talk, have far better trade flows between all three countries if we found a way to have a smarter border relationship. I just got back I went down literally to the wine country in Baja California on Monday, celebrating President's Day in Mexico, and it was wonderful. You know, you drive an hour and a half south. We had a little bit of a delay going south because CBP was inspecting cars. There was about a 15-minute delay to get south into Mexico, and that's become increasingly common in the last few years, thanks to a joint agreement between the United States and Mexico called the Merida Initiative. One of the pillars of that initiative is a 21st century border, which is, again, paradoxically, the idea that we're going to harden the border for southbound flows. But anyway, we got down there. We had a wonderful time. Some of the oldest wineries, the Santo Tomas Winery, the oldest winery in North America, probably in the Americas. Excellent Tempranillo. I would recommend it to all of you. We made our way back to the border, and fortunately, I have the Fast Pass, the Sentry Pass, that lets you get across. It's $150. It takes forever to get it, and you have to basically promise your firstborn and give them all of your credit card numbers and receipts and all of this stuff. It's just part of the NSA's general strategy to keep us all under control. You get your Sentry card, you get across. We were across in 10 minutes. Unfortunately, the vast majority of people who cross the border don't have this luxury, and the people who I was driving with got out of my car and stood in line in the longest pedestrian lines that along the whole U.S.-Mexico border. They waited for 2 hours in the dark. One of them is a colleague of mine who has to have surgery in a week for a leg for her leg. There's no handicap line. We have a lot of things that we need to sort out at the border to make this really a more integrated region and to allow people, goods, and capital to really move in sync more fluidly across the border. I'm not even going to mention immigration because I figure we're going to touch on that in Q&A, but I think that's an important part of the question of the future of North America. And I'm not talking about, like, are we going to get immigration reform in 2014? Because I already know the answer to that. It's no. The question is, what is North America going to look like in 50 years? Is North America going to look like Europe? Are we going to have a Schengen agreement for North America, which allows people, as the Schengen Accords or Schengen Acquis in Europe, allow people to move freely between countries in Europe? Of course, Europe's rethinking that at this very moment, or at least certain countries in Europe are rethinking that. But is that the trajectory that we are going in? Is it a trajectory we want to go in to allow freer flows of labor and people in North America? The thing everyone is talking about, and particularly today, is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this idea that we're going to be able to look east to the future of North America and try to find ways to partner with Australia, Japan, and some other Southeast Asian countries as a way, also some other countries in South America, as a way of forging a stronger trade relationship. And I think there's a lot of reasons to be skeptical about this idea. Not just because of the sort of, just because of labor objections or any particular political agendas associated with the TPP. But one of the things I really wanted to underscore and hope I underscored in this presentation is there are certain comparative advantages and certain intrinsic connections between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. Certain compatibilities that make for natural trade relationships. And I'm not sure that those really exist for some of these other countries in the Pacific Rim. Our proximity, our ability to move goods relatively quickly from place to place, to manufacture a product partly in Mexico, partly in Canada, and partly in the United States, and have that all come together quickly and relatively efficiently is what makes our region strong. And arguably, that is something that we won't be able to find by expanding out across the Pacific. It may allow for some greater trade flows, But really, the secret of North America is that North America works and works effectively together because we are really part of the same economic region. We're close to becoming, I would say, one economic region. And that is really what I think we should think of as the legacy of NAFTA. So thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions and have some discussion.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.